Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and start with panel three now. Before we start, I want to introduce our next moderator, Professor Richard Herman. Professor K. Richard Herman is Professor of Political Science and Director of the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at The Ohio State University. He has written widely on politics in the Middle East, international security, and American foreign policy. From 1989 to 1991, Professor Herman served on Secretary of State James Baker's policy planning staff at the U.S. Department of State. And from 1991 to 1996, he served as co-editor of the International Studies Quarterly, the flagship journal of the International Studies Association. Professor Herman has been a frequent visitor to the Middle East, lecturing and conducting research in Israel and the West Bank, as well as Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and United Arab Emirates. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome Professor Herman.
Thank you, Michael, and thank all of you for coming. It's a great pleasure for the Mershon Center to work together with the Maritz College of Law. We're very pleased to be a partner in this important conference, and I'm glad that we could make this happen, and I'm very grateful to the students who run the Journal on Dispute Resolution for the wonderful cast of characters they've brought here, so I'm really pleased to be associated with this. My job is a pleasant and relatively easy one. I'm going to introduce the panelists this afternoon. We're going to have four presentations. The first will be on Northern Ireland, and it will be a tag team in some ways between Dominic Bryan and Michael Hamilton. And then we'll proceed to the Middle East and on to two different discussions of South Africa. But I'm going to come back up to the podium and introduce David and Nisitu Leu and Gareth separately, and then we'll have a discussant from Haggett. Is that right? Dominic, so we'll start with Northern Ireland, which will be done by Dominic and Michael collectively. Dr. Dominic Bryan is director of the Institute for Irish Studies at Queen's University Belfast. He's also a lecturer in social anthropology at the university. He's an internationally renowned expert on Northern Ireland parades, and his research has included the political anthropology, public ritual, public order, and policing. He's the author of the report on parades, protest, and policing, a human rights framework done for the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission in 2001. He's also the author of the book Orange Parades, the Politics of Ritual, Traditions, and Control. He's engaged in two important research projects now, one on the issues of representation and how they've been dealt with since the signing of the Belfast Agreement, and a second major research project on democratic dialogue. Following him and then alternating with him will be Michael Hamilton. Michael Hamilton is a lecturer in the Transitional Justice Institute at the University of Ulster. He's focused on the legal regulation of public protest, and in particular the parade dispute in Northern Ireland. He's delivered human rights training to conflict resolution practitioners on behalf of the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission and the Institute for Conflict Research. He also has published The Freedom of Assembly, Consequential Harms, and the Rule of Law, Liberty-Limiting Principles in the Context of Transition. Without further ado, Dominic, do you want to begin?
And I thank you very much for the invite. We've been treated very kindly here, and it's very nice to be amongst such knowledgeable people and to have this discussion. Michael and I are going to do this as a double act. Although Michael has been changing the presentation in his room without telling me. Originally, it was he had lots of animation in it, because he really wants a job with Pixar. But he tells me he's taken all that out. So when the screens come up, they might be just as much revealing to me as they are to you. Right, what we want, very, very briefly, and we're going to try and get this in a 20-minute slot, what we want to do is we will want to look at the context of Northern Ireland. So we're going to give you a quick background briefing of the context of Northern Ireland. Within that, we're going to look at various public order disputes. We're going to look at case studies around that, three particular case studies, and we're going to come to some sorts of conclusions around that. So the first thing to point out very briefly is the importance of public order disputes in the conflict in Northern Ireland, and I'm not going to go through a history now, but many of you will know that the disputes were sort of generated with parades, civil rights parades in the 1960s. The control of space in Belfast and Northern Ireland generally has been maintained as a really important element of the way the conflict has proceeded. And Belfast, as well as rural areas, is now divided territorially. And you can see various pictures displayed there of events and barriers and aspects of policing which mark territory. So the first thing to say is how important public order disputes are. The second thing we want to say is, of course, we've been in a significant period of change in Northern Ireland. We've had what's been called a peace process, which, depending on which side you're on, you can date from the mid-80s or the mid-90s, which we thought culminated in an agreement in 98. And in fact, the process has rolled on. The political elements of it, the agreement to have an assembly, has been in abeyance for some time because of a lack of agreement over some of the issues that we're going to talk about. But the amount of what I would call organised political violence has reduced over that period of time, which culminated this year in the IRA. Decommissioning all its weapons, which, you know, for those of us, I'm not originally from Ireland, but have lived there 20 years, if you'd have told us that was going to happen 15 years ago, even perhaps 5 years ago, we'd have laughed at you, you know. So it's been a phenomenal process of change. Key to that process of change has been changes in the nature of policing. And we've shifted from the old police force, which was the Royal Ulster Constabulary, and you can see their caps displayed there, to the new police service of Northern Ireland. You can see the new badge, which, for those of us, I'm an anthropologist by trade. You can tell I'm an anthropologist because I'm dressed like that rather than the lawyer dressed like that. You know, it's obviously the different uniforms we all wear. I'm intensely interested by things like symbols and how these have come about with. And the changing in policing was precisely important because of the way physical force, territory had been controlled. The police were a predominantly Protestant and unionist organisation, and part of the process of the peace process had to be a change process for the police. Now, the many arguments as to how successful that process has been. What I think you can't argue is that there has been significant changes. I suspect even the most hardline Irish Republicans would accept there have been changes. Many of them would argue not enough, but that there have been changes. And I put down there four issues which I think are relate to this and that we can talk about. First of all was the need for acceptable policing. Many of the communities in Northern Ireland, Catholic and to a certain extent Protestant, do not accept the police as being legitimate. So there was a need to try and create a policing circumstances where the police were seen as legitimate. I suspect this is also true of many other communities around the world, and it's not particular to Northern Ireland. Secondly, the policy arena, and much of this was being learnt from America, of course, was to develop notions of community policing. Thirdly, to develop those notions within a framework of human rights. And fourthly, to try and develop forms of public order policing, and this is what we will talk about in a little bit more detail, which would in some senses conform to the community policing and to human rights. And what we're going to talk about a little bit is some of the contradictions that exist between the human rights aspects and the community policing aspect. All right, so very, very briefly, the context in which policing takes place in Northern Ireland. firstly, it's a territorial, one of marked territories. That map of Belfast, the green shows you the Catholic, Irish nationalist areas. The red show you the Protestant, British areas. Even the pink areas and the, obviously you can guess from a conservative place like Northern Ireland that the pink areas are not the gay community. They are confined to about one pub in the centre of Belfast. The pink and the yellow areas, which suggest mixing, even those areas are less mixed than you would think. And in fact, Belfast has become more divided since the peace process has taken place. The process of building walls that divide the community, the one on the far left there and the middle one, is the along the Springfield Road between the Shankill and the Falls Road in West Belfast. So we have a highly territorialised city and territorialised society with interfaces, that's what we call the meeting areas with Catholic and Protestant communities. It has to be said, it's very obvious, this is also in broadly working class areas. These areas are obviously often marked by flags and emblems, by the use of murals, and we'll be coming to that later. It's also marked by violence, and we have paramilitary groups in both communities that violently control, and by some of the communities be seen as the legitimate bearers of violence in that community. All right, so we have paramilitarism within the community. Within the Protestant community, some areas are controlled by the UVF, one of the band groups, and the other controlled by the UDA. So even Protestant areas are divided by different paramilitary groups. Much of these areas are marked by routine parades and demonstrations around everything from St. Patrick's Day to the 12th of July. So these parades and demonstrations in turn mark territory, as does violence, as does the use of emblems. And we would also get frequent recreational rioting. You know, young people have been brought up, used to throwing stones, and clashes at interfaces are very common. Oh, we animated this bit. There we go. Fantastic. So the first thing is to say the that caught me. The first thing to say is that we've had an introduction of community-style policing. And we're going to come back to why we think there's a problem with community, because we community, as I've tended to put it, community has some bad sides. You know, there are things about communities that we shouldn't actually like. All right. That's what the Patton report, the Patton report was the big report on policing change, said, that policing with the community should be the core function of the police service and the core function of every police station. But problems with community. Firstly, the nature of identity communities, all right? And the fact that these are not always communities which just... in the nice, cosy way of close relationships. These are communities that are bound together by political identity, all right? And that has some ramifications, you know? So we mustn't live with the ideas that these communities are the sense of pre-industrial throwback where everybody lives happily together. Secondly, when you have relationships with this community, you've got to decide who the legitimate power holders in that community that you're going to engage with. And, as I suggested just earlier, we have paramilitaries in communities. So often that means engaging with paramilitaries. You know, and you've got to think of the effects that sort of engagement would have. And thirdly, to draw on a sort of, I do a ridiculous thing with a Star Wars presentation, to talk about a dark side of community, all right? Community is about control of boundaries. And community excludes people, all right? So we mustn't take community as something that's necessarily nice, rosy, and good. And we're going to come back to that towards the end. Right, so I'm going to hand over to Michael, and we're going to quickly look at the three case studies which we think are pertinent.
Okay, I'm not going to rise to any of the antagonistic comments that were made by an anthropologist. But the three case studies that we're going to touch on are, first of all, the Parades Commission, then mechanisms that have been instituted to deal with flag disputes, which Dominic's going to come back and talk about, and then thirdly, mobile or cell phone networks. So first of all, the Parades Commission. The context that this has taken place in has been a more generalized and well-documented shift where governments and states aren't seen as unilateral guarantors of security, but are more seen in the role of facilitator and animator and partner in that function. And it's also in the context of a shift in policing and public order policing, which has been discussed in terms of a move from escalated force public order policing towards negotiated management. And going back in time to the mid-1990s in Northern Ireland, there was at that stage a crisis in policing. And it was a crisis precipitated in part by two large-scale public order disputes which around which there was widespread violence in 1995 and 1996, the Drumcree parades dispute. And it was also structurally induced because in 1998, only 8% of the police force, which was then the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the RUC, only 8% were from the Catholic community. So at that point, the police problem, or the policing problem around the parades issue, was summed up by the chief constable, who said that much too much was being expected of the police in terms of affecting community reconciliation. And that, I suppose, resonates with Jay's comment earlier on about how the policing job is quite a tragic profession. And the expectations of the community were not only that the police would police these parades, but that somehow in doing so they would affect some large-scale transformation. And what happened in 1997, following those 2 years of violent dispute, was that there was an attempt to broaden the discourse away from just public order policing, to draw on a wider range of tools to manage public order. And that involved devolving responsibility for policing away from the traditional structures of the police. And the way in which that was done was through legislation, and legislation set up this body called the Parades Commission. And the Parades Commission is a 7-member body, which by statute is supposed to be representative of the community. And I'll come back in a second to that phrase, whatever representative of the community means. It's also in some ways independent of the state, and that's contentious because, as Ellen earlier on said, the Parades Commission is established by legislation, and so it has that air of official authority about it. It's also staffed by a secretariat who are entirely drawn from the civil service, so its independence is in many ways questionable. The functions of the Parades Commission are twofold primarily, and it's a hybrid body. The first function has been to take over the police adjudication role around the decisions around parades and the routes that the parades can take, the types of music that can be played by bands, the types of banners that can be carried. And the adjudicative role of the Commission is something which they very much say this is a last resort. We will only come in as an adjudicative body if there is failure to reach local agreement about the parade route. The police, of course, still do enforce the Parades Commission's ruling, but they do so in a more depoliticized context because they're not taking the decision and then having to police their own decision. So in that way, the Parades Commission serves as a buffer, as an institutional buffer, to allow the new structures of policing in Northern Ireland to take root. The second function, then, is that the Parades Commission has a statutory duty to facilitate mediation. So in addition to the 7 commissioners, we have what are known as 12 authorised officers. And the authorised officers work in teams of 2 across Northern Ireland. And what they do is they try to intervene before a parade or a public event comes up and foster some kind of agreement about the parties, between the parties. And they will also intervene on the day of the event and work between the organisers of the parade and protest and the police. There have also, I should say as well, been a number of other roles created as a result of the establishment of the Parades Commission. There are around 20 or 30 monitors who now go out and monitor parades and report to the Parades Commission. And there's been a larger project of training stewards or marshals within the parading organisations, so that with the end game being that those organisations begin to take responsibility for their own events and policing their own events to some degree. So the progress, to give some way of evaluation of the Parades Commission, the progress has been the authorised officers, these new roles, have brought new possibilities for crisis management in a way that there was not beforehand. The presence of monitors on the ground in these lovely fluorescent jackets does very visibly create a third-party presence on the ground, and in doing that, there's been a lot of effort in trying to make monitoring an acceptable and legitimate role in Northern Ireland society. So the monitors, examples of good practice have been that monitors have been invited to police briefings, and that picks up on the earlier point that was made about how the police are very often resistant to outsiders coming in. And it's not been uniform across Northern Ireland, but there have been examples where the police have welcomed these new roles into the traditional policing structures. So in conclusion, in some ways, on the Parades Commission and the progress that's been made, this increased scrutiny that the Parades Commission has brought to bear, there's been increased scrutiny on how the police enforce the Commission's determinations, and this new dynamic of partnership working with these new roles has been a catalyst in allowing new policing structures to take root. Some of the problems, though, have been that there's still deep-rooted conflict. As Dominic said, Belfast is more segregated now than it was before the Parades Commission was set up. One of the major parties in the Parades dispute still refuses to recognise the authority of the Parades Commission, the Orange Order. And although in many ways establishing the Parades Commission has remedied one of the structural defects that existed before it was set up, the fact that nationalists had no input into these public order decisions and the regulation of public space, there's a question over what representativeness actually means. So when you have a 7-member body that is required to be representative of the community, does that simply mean a sectarian headcount where you have 3 Protestants and 3 Catholics sitting on a body, a kind of institutionalized devil's advocacy? And I think it's fair to say that we're experimenting with this. We've just had a new commission appointed, and the new commission has 2 members of the Orange Order actually sitting on that 7-member body. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not that works. There's also, and I'm not going to have time to go into this in great detail, but because of this hybrid function of the commission, its role in adjudicating and its other role in mediating, there are issues around how the mediators relate to the adjudicatory body. And the mediators have so far reported to the commission on progress that has been made in any attempt to facilitate an agreement. And that creates problems, as you might imagine. It creates problems for people's trust in the mediation process, where essentially, instead of engaging with one another with a view to a long-term solution of the Parades dispute, they talk to mediators as a way of talking to the adjudicatory body. So they talk through the mediators to the commission, and so they still position themselves. And I think one of the key criticisms that could be made of the Parades Commission is that it hasn't yet moved people beyond strategic communication to more transformative modes of communication. Back to Dominic.
Right, I'm very quickly, that's 20 minutes, all right, I'm very, very quickly going to go through this because we want to get to our conclusions. The flying of flags is also a major problem, a marker of territory. In Northern Ireland, we couldn't have a national flag flying on a podium here because half the audience would walk out. So marking territory is done. Now, unlike, and many of these are, as these figures show here, they're flown by paramilitaries as well. So many people find the flying of flags intimidating. I'm going to run right across. So the flags issue, it's part of people's tradition. They say it's a celebration. They want to put their flags up, as societies do all around the world. And argue they should do so, but in actual fact, what it does is it marks territories. So should you stop people flying flags? A lot of the flags are illegal anyway. All right. And what we have is a situation, unlike with the Parades Commission, there's no legislation that directly covers it. All right. And the local council, the road service, the housing executive, and the PSNI all tend to avoid doing anything about it. All right. So there's... What's been done to attempt to alleviate this is to increase, there's been recommendations to increase the number of individuals mediating disputes, increase funding for organisations transforming the conflict through environmental work, and an attempt to develop a more coordinated approach. But I want to just mention the bottom one about providing a contact point between agencies, because the police have been designated as the group that is to coordinate dealing with this conflict. And in actual fact, if you read the top line there under section 2.4, to provide a proactive approach with the support of communities and their representatives to address, and it goes along through a whole load of problems with flags flying outside council buildings, etc., etc., etc. The bit that I want to, I'll use it, flag up, all right, is the fact that when the police do their negotiating, essentially they have to negotiate with the paramilitary groups. In effect, in trying to get the flags down, they are often empowering those people who are utilising illegal violence within their communities. So the one thing we wanted to show with these examples is one of the problems when you're trying to mediate these processes in how you engage with communities. All right, so I'm quickly going to...
which I'm going to do in 30 seconds. We'll not really have time to go into this case study in any detail at all, but the point that we want to bring out of this is that cell phone networks are very simply a way of improving communication between those communities living on interfaces, and there's been a move to fund groups working on either side of the interfaces to have mobile or cell phones which they can use to communicate with each other, to communicate in some occasions with the police, but that's been problematic for obvious reasons in a number of areas. And the question becomes, who in the community do you give the phones to? And the political reality of the situation is that very often these phones go to those who have paramilitary connections, direct or otherwise. And one of the challenges in this particular case study is to devolve responsibility further. So it's not just that the paramilitaries are all the time being asked to respond to these interface disputes, but that others in the community are being brought in as well. Conclusion?
Don't end conclusions, yeah. So can we, just to conclude, we got lots of pictures. Right. Quickly, we've looked at ways in which public order policing has developed a community-based approach, and that responsibility is devolved through both policy and legislation. Where we raise questions is that when you devolve responsibility for public order to the community, you can often be devolving responsibility in quite a problematic way and empowering parts of the community which you should feel somewhat uncomfortable with. And that's because there is a dark side to the community. That is because within communities, people control and exclude and draw boundaries. And in some senses, we want a community-based approach in Northern Ireland, but also the community is a part of the problem.
Thank you, both of you, Dominic and Michael. We're going to move now to the Middle East. David Weisberg and Hagit Lernau. David Weisberg is the Walter E. Meyer Professor of Law and Criminal Justice at the Hebrew University and is also a faculty member at the University of Maryland's Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice. He's authored or co-authored more than 14 books and 60 articles on community policing, white-collar crime, and crime mapping. Professor Weisbird has also served as the principal investigator on a number of policing-related projects for local, state, federal, and international governments, universities, and private organizations, including the National Institute of Justice, the Israeli Anti-Drug Authority, and the Office of the Attorney General from New Jersey. Professor Weisbird is currently working with Hagit Lernau on a project in conjunction with the United States Institute for Peace entitled Isolation and Violence in the Promised Land. He's published many things, as I've mentioned. Some include Police Innovation, Contrasting Perspectives. I'll just pick a few of the highlights. What Police Can Do to Reduce Crime, Disorder, and Fear, Community Policing in Israel, Resistance and Change. And today, he's just flown from Israel, and so we appreciate the effort he's made. David?
You can try to get it up, because if I try to do that, there'll be a problem. I'll talk in the meanwhile while you're doing that. Let me say that normally the kind of things I'm interested in would fit extremely well into this conference, but the topic I'm going to talk about today, at first glance, it might not seem like it fits very well, though Laura and others thought it was useful and interesting to listen to. It reminded me a bit of an experience I had a bit ago in Jerusalem, where someone called me up on the phone and asked for, said, is Amir there? And I said, no, excuse me, you must have the wrong number. And 2 minutes later, the phone rang again. I picked up the phone and said, hello. And the person said, you again? So hopefully it won't be like that. Hopefully I'll let you know a little bit about what the relevance is of the work we did for some of the topics you're talking about today, because I think it is relevant. The title of our presentation is What Prevented Violence in Jewish Settlements in the Withdrawal from the Gaza Strip? Towards a Perspective of Normative Balance. As already noted, Hagit and I did this together, and it was funded by the U.S. Institute for Peace. And let me give you just, this will help in a little bit of background. Of course, the disengagement that occurred this summer, people in Israel thought this would lead to a terrible, terrible conflict. Indeed, it was very common to see quotes like these in the newspapers. For example, the first from Maariv, one of the major Israeli dailies, and this is a translation of it, by the way. Poll, most of settlers will be violent. 9 of 10 Israelis fear settler violence toward army and police forces that will participate in the evacuation. Of course, this tells you something about newspapers. Poll, most of the settlers will be violent, and then it's telling us what people think the settlers will do in the poll, actually. But anyway, results will be presented to a national council, which will discuss the question, are we facing a civil war? Second, a professor from Ben-Gurion University predicts that the disengagement process will deteriorate to bloodshed. It has been said that most of the groups involved here have an interest to advance or push the situation into violence. So that was the sort of view, the sense, the feelings. People were very nervous and very frightened. People talked about stockpiles of weapons. And as someone who did research in the settlements a number of years earlier, I can say that that's a possibility, not necessarily something completely unlikely. People were afraid of terrible things happening. Now, in practice, the withdrawal itself proceeded with little physical violence, but let me note something. In the months leading up to withdrawal, there were protests, civil protests all over the place. Thousands of young people were arrested by the police. There were isolated but very significant incidents where two individuals burned themselves, put themselves on fire, and two Jewish terrorists from the Samaria region, I'll talk about that in a few minutes, They committed terrorist attacks, not against the government, but against Israeli Arab citizens, and 8 people were killed. So it's not that there wasn't any violence, but the kind of grand conflict, if you like, the civil sort of war or civil strife that was predicted when this would happen didn't seem to occur. Indeed, 8,000 people were transferred, 21 communities were evacuated and destroyed. The withdrawal took only 7 days. People started talking about months of being embroiled in a conflict. And indeed, a month later, the Israeli army, as the government wanted, withdrew from the Gaza Strip after 38 years of Israeli presence there. Now, these are the pictures from the withdrawal. I'm sure you saw them, right? They were pictures that were difficult, but they weren't the pictures of grenades and things of this sort that people had in mind. There's a settler being pulled away by security forces. Here's someone crying, being taken away from their home. That was the color of the withdrawal advocates. Against withdrawal, wore that orange color. And here's a case where a woman's taking her baby and showing it to the soldiers and saying, and this is what you're doing, you're dragging these children from their home, etc. Now, the questions I want to talk about are, why was there so little actual violence in the withdrawals? I said before, there were violent incidents. But if the settlers had radical ideas that would justify and encourage violence, why did violence not occur when the government uprooted settlements as settlers? I mean, the view was, in one sense, these guys had these ideas that made this issue cataclysmic. This was an incredible issue. So why did it go seemingly so smoothly? And the second is, and very important, because Chagit and I actually decided to do this before the withdrawal, but our interest was, how could we prevent more serious violence? The second is, what are the implications of what happened in the Gaza Strip for possible future government actions in the West Bank, in the areas that biblical areas of Judea and Samaria? Now, let me tell you just a little bit about this study. I don't have very much time, but I'll give you a little glance of it. Our study was developed to examine the potential violence. As I noted, we looked at 4 settlements from the Gaza Strip, 6 settlements from the West Bank. We chose the settlements because they were ideological, meaning this is not a random sample of settlers from these areas. These are places where the people were seen as more extreme. We also chose the settlements because they were isolated. We wanted places we thought likely to be removed in the case of withdrawal. And we started talking about this. There was no talk about withdrawal. And then all of a sudden, we did have the disengagement. Some of these settlements were moved. So they had to be isolated. By the way, all the settlements we studied were outside the security fence now being built in Israel. In terms of characteristics of the settlements, we don't have time to go into the table, but as you can see, these places have been around a long time, some of them. I visited, for example, Atzmona and Mavo Dotan in the 1970s. Some of them are relatively newer, but a lot of these settlements had been on the ground for many years, enough for children to grow up in them, etc. Households, they're generally small. Neve de Kalim is more of a community, more of a sort of small town. We chose it because it was in Gaza Strip, but most of the communities are relatively small number of families. As I said, the residency is relatively long. Another very important fact is these are communities of people that take religion extremely seriously. This is not a minor issue for them. These settlements are composed of nationalist Orthodox Jews, people who take their religion very, very seriously. That's why they move to these areas often. One settlement, Mavo Dotan, is composed mostly of secular Israelis. But that settlement, actually, we're going to pull out of the data I show you now because it's really quite different than the others. In terms of the settlers themselves, they're a fairly traditional group. Most of the settlers are in their 30s, the average age. They're mostly married. They have a lot of children, right, especially compared to the American context, but even compared to Israel, where the average number of children is a bit larger, to have 6.4 children for a minimum of a family, for example, in Atzmona, is very, very large. And most of the settlements are places where people have large families. I will say that it's not that these places are sort of poverty-stricken sort of areas, because we often have a look at a number of children and poverty and these sorts of issues. If you look at these statistics on the percent with a BA in Israel, it's not that common to have a college degree, and many people in the settlements do. Now, in terms of location, and I suspect from all the newspapers, et cetera, you know about this, this is the Gaza Strip over here. Here's a blow-up of it. The green is the settlements. They don't take up quite that much area, but the point is that they were all located in this block over here, Ganatel, Neve de Kalim, Shirat Hayam, and Atzmona. We divide the West Bank into 2 areas, the Samaria area. These are the settlements we're going to be interested over here, and in Judea, Beit Yatir and Susia over here. And as I'll talk about later at the end, there's quite a difference we found between the views of the people who live in these different areas. Even a small place, there can be differences in terms of blocks or groups that have a lot of interaction with each other. Now, in terms of just getting a sense of what these places look like, this is Neve de Kalim before it was redrawn from. Red roofs, etc. Looks very pleasant, a nice place to live. This is Ganei Tal, again, sort of nice by Israeli standards, by the way. Those are very nice houses. Most Israelis live in apartments. Land is very expensive. In the settlements, the government offered quite often housing that was could be bigger, etc., than in other areas. Now, just about the data collected, for a 6-month period, we conducted numerous observations of life in the settlements, especially of events related to withdrawal, protests, etc. We conducted 64 in-depth interviews. And then, importantly, and I'll show you some of these data, in the 2 months before the withdrawal from Gaza, we conducted a survey, a random sample of 449 settlers. It was a very difficult process. The government closed Gaza for a bit. We had to get special permission to get in, etc. Much is owed to Chagit for being able to carry that out. We also conducted 108 surveys in the West Bank before the withdrawal and 108 afterwards. Now, surprising to us, only one settlement that we went to, Sanur, didn't let us in the settlement. And that was surprising because these people are in the midst of this great crisis. And to let people in, to ask them questions, et cetera, some they may consider from the university to be sort of enemies at the outset, if you like, I thought was very interesting in itself. The response rate for the survey, given the situation, was also very good. It was 80%. Surveys like this often get 50 or 55% response rates, and that's considered good. Now, the first question really is, well, did the settlers in the Gaza Strip have radical beliefs that would justify and encourage violence? Why is that important? Because maybe there was not as much violence as people expected, because these people really didn't have such crazy beliefs. Maybe they didn't think the issue of the settlements in the Gaza Strip was so cataclysmic. It was like if you told me you were going to give me money for my house and move me to a house down the street or in a community nearby, I'd say, okay, you know, just make it so I can move to a nicer area. But the assumption was they had these views. But if they didn't, that would, of course, provide an explanation. Here are just some questions from the survey, and this is just of the Gaza settlers. The first is, settling in Yesha is part of the process of the redemption of Israel, Gulat Yisrael. Now, this is very important because these are very religious people, and when they talk about the Messianic Age, they mean it. They're not just saying the Messianic Age is something that will come. This is something very serious to them. And as you can see, 95% of these settlers say, settling in Yesha, by the way, Yesha is Yehuda, Shomron, and Gaza, Judea, Samaria, and the Gaza Strip. Settling these areas is a part of the redemption of Israel. The second question is related. A withdrawal from Yesha will prevent Gulat Yisrael. A withdrawal from these territories will prevent the Messianic Age from coming. And many of these people believe that the process of settlement of the Israeli victory in 1967 was part of a God-inspired redemption of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. So this is a very serious issue. You're going to stop that. If you pull out of here, you're going to stop the redemption of the Jewish people. Renunciation of any part of Eretz Yisrael is Yehereg va'al yavor. The problem is there's no way of translating that. It means you should be killed rather than transgress. But it's actually a Talmudic dictum, and the Talmudic dictum says that for all of the commandments that God gave in the Torah, you're allowed to transgress them to save someone's life. You're not allowed to work on the Sabbath, but if work on the Sabbath will save someone's life, like in a hospital, you can work. You're not allowed to commit to rob or steal, but if you have to save someone's life, then that can be justifiable. All the mitzvot, except a very small group. And what is that group? One is murder. The other is apostasy. Okay, so you have here these people saying, withdrawing from these territories is yereg v'al yavor. Withdrawing from these territories is one of those things like murder, etc., they just can't do. And as you can see, about two-thirds of the settlers agreed with that view. Now, finally, something that kept being said at the time was these people will eventually be judged. History will judge those who helped to evacuate settlements, and they will be prosecuted as traitors. And 78% of the settlers that we surveyed in Gaza said, yes, that's right. Now, obviously, the settlers take this very, very seriously. This is cataclysmic. How much more cataclysmic can you get than the Messianic Age and Yereg V'Avor for these people is a total, like, different level of religious situation. Here are just some quotes related to this. The land of Israel is not an inheritance, it's a legacy. Things that I get as inheritance are mine, but if I so desire, I can give them up. But a legacy is something that belongs to the Jewish people for all generations. It cannot be relinquished. In other words, you can't do this. It's impossible to do. How can you do something that's not in your power to do? The moment you move one Jew from the land of Israel, the moment you start to withdraw due to fear of terror, we have lost the battle of the land of Israel. Israel has lost the battle for its own existence, a more secular kind of view of the problem, but nonetheless, again, placing this problem in a very serious light. And this is another thing about it's not within the legitimate authority for the government or people to withdraw from these areas. Okay, so there is a basis. If you say the withdrawal from these areas is like, you know, stops the Messianic Age, it's equivalent, and you take the laws of the Torah very seriously, it's equivalent to murder or apostasy. It's like of the most terrible thing you can do. Obviously, it provides a sort of radical view, if you like. Now, the question is, okay, maybe they had these radical views, and maybe they supported violence, but maybe the government acted in such a way, the military and the police, that you just couldn't carry it out. So we asked some questions about support for violence. Now, it's always hard when you ask people about this support for violence, but, you know, it's the best you can do in some sense. Physical response towards someone who would raise his or hand or anyone close to me. This is a sense where if someone did something to you, would you respond in the case of withdrawal? And about 28% of the settlers that, that we interviewed said yes. Piercing tires and damaging vehicles of the army of police. The army had to drive into this area through part of the West Bank, so you could put out barriers and keep them from coming. Only 10% thought that was legitimate or that they would do it. Physical response against anyone who would participate in uprooting settlements. In other words, I would use something physical, and by physical in Hebrew, it's a bit problematic because it also includes things like pushing or hitting or punching, not only shooting, etc. Only 2.5% of the settlers said that. Violence against Arabs in order to provoke Jewish-Arab conflict. This was something interesting to us because that did happen, as I mentioned before. But here, 2.5%, almost 97.5% of the people said no, and in this size of survey, only a few settlers said yes. Violent revolt, only two of the settlers that we interviewed, about 1.5%, said that they would be involved. Okay, so the portrait is very strong and radical beliefs about this issue of the settlements, on the one hand. On the other hand, you ask about violence. No, that's not appropriate, even in this situation. It's not appropriate to do that. Now, how do we explain this contradiction? That's what interests us, and I think is related to some of the issues coming up here. And we call this a perspective of normative balance. It comes from a well-known sociologist who used to be, it was at Indiana University in the 1930s, 40s, and early 50s, named Edwin Sutherland, and he proposed a very well-known theory of differential associations and crime. And a key component of Sutherland's theory was a person becomes delinquent because of an excess of definitions favorable to violation over the law, of the law over definitions unfavorable to violation of law. In other words, Sutherland said that what happens is people come with these two sets of norms, if you like, one pushing them towards violating the law and something pushing them against. What happens is when that balance goes like this, that's when you begin to see criminal behavior. Now, we think that the violence, the lack of violence during the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip can be understood in this context of a model of normative balance. While settlers express norms regarding the land and settlement that, in my view at least, would naturally lead to serious violence, they also claim to support norms that emphasize their connections to the larger society and that acted to constrain the potential for violence. In other words, this was not a unidimensional problem. These people had these elements of different norms acting upon them at the same time, as do many people, for example, Catholics in America, to believe abortion is murder. If abortion is the Holocaust, why aren't you doing something about it? Obviously, there are competing norms acting on people at the same time, and I'll just give you examples from our survey. The unity of the Jewish people and the existence of the State of Israel are more important than the territories. 62% of the settlers said that. In other words, the issue of the unity of the Jewish people is another norm I believe in. The issue of the State of Israel is another norm I believe in. Well, it's more important than this, or at least it's another very important norm. I must respect the law and the government decisions, even if I personally disagree with them. It's a norm, it's an idea that, yes, people have to do that. About two-thirds of the settlers said that. And as a democratic state, Israel must be tolerant of a wide range of different opinions and ways of life. About almost 90% of the settlers said that. Now, mind you, I must say that at this point what they were saying was they should be listening to us. They're not listening to us now, but nonetheless they expressed the norm. You can see this in the... I actually have like 10 whole minutes or something left, don't I? Yeah, it's better than I thought. Now I can slow down. If you speak quickly, you get... Anyway, if you listen to these quotes, they definitely give you this sense of what's going on. I look at this plan, the disengagement, with the utmost severity, and I think it is a crime to do something like this. We believe that the right way is to increase light instead of creating darkness. The solution is working to create unity instead of creating a rupture. The settlers here love the people of Israel. Whereas, you know, we're also part of the people of Israel, so how do we, you know, it's hard to justify that at the same time and use violence. In the Torah, the importance of the settlement is immense. But it's not only a matter of Torah is the Bible, by the way. Am I going to obey the words of the Torah? It is also a matter of the possibility of a civil war. If I resist a soldier, I can create an opening for a civil war. This soldier that will come to evacuate me is my brother. Now, one of the things we're doing is also looking at the networks of the settlers to other Israelis. And our view is that as there are more social networks, there's less likelihood of violence. Now, let me say something now that there is an implication here for the way the government or the police or others should deal with these sorts of situations. While the attitudes of the settlers help us to understand the low level of violence in the withdrawal, we also think that the army approach helped to reinforce the sort of normative framework that we're talking about. This idea of making those connections, of creating norms that made it difficult to use violence against the army or against the government. And these are just some pictures. Now, this is, if you know a little bit about Israel, you know how atypical this is. In Israel, if someone gives you a face or does something, you whatever, you react immediately. This is an expressive society. This is, you know, a place where people yell at each other in the street as part of the cultural context. And here the soldiers were told to relax, sit back, don't react, people call you names or whatever, don't respond, just sort of stand there. Another thing they did was the soldiers were encouraged to interact with people. And here is a situation where there was a prayer service set up, and the soldiers went over and they joined probably the rabbi here and put their arms around each other and started praying together. Now, it's hard to shoot the people you're praying with, so to speak. It's hard to respond in that kind of way of people that you're making these kinds of connections to. Now, I will say something else. One of the things, and this is well known in policing, if you want to stop a riot, bring 10 times as many police. And the government did do that. There were massive numbers of police. They came, by the way, without weapons. Another element here. Don't flame things. Don't create things. Now, of course, I should note, there's a large army base just a mile or two away, or a few miles away, and if something did happen, they could have been in there in a minute. But you can see the massive force that came. Okay, so this is our explanation, our take, of why the level of violence was lower than at least some people had predicted and feared. Now, the question is, what are the implications for future withdrawals? What might you expect? Now, let me just say that the data we have overall from the West Bank, both from Judea and Samaria, tend to reflect some of the things we saw here. But there's a slight difference, and the difference is even picked up more in our qualitative work. And let me just show you. There's a lot to look at on a slide, but the first two are things you saw before about history will judge those who will help to evacuate the settlements, renunciation of any part of Eretz Israel, Yareg Val Yavor, you can't transgress it, you should be killed rather than transgress. But if you look between the Gush Katif, in other words, between the Gaza Strip, between Samaria and Judea, there's not much of a difference. There's not a statistically significant difference in anything. When we look at issues related to normative balance, these other issues that might constrain, there are differences. Here in each case, as a democratic state, Israel must be tolerant of a wide range of opinion. The settlers in Samaria were much less likely to say that, and I must respect the law and government decisions if I personally disagree with them. Again, even more so, less likely, in both cases, statistically significant. Now, if our model is correct, then we should also find a greater willingness of settlers in Samaria to use violence, and indeed, to some extent, that's what they find. Violent revolt and use of firearms. There still aren't enough settlers to do any kinds of statistical analysis, but it's still the case that you can see the tendency, and there's a whole series of questions like this, is for the settlers in Samaria to be more willing to participate in acts of violence. All means are legitimate to prevent the renunciation of any part of the land of Israel, Eretz Israel. And here again, you can see that the settlers in Samaria are quite a bit different than settlers in other areas. Now, just sort of the qualitative interviews in our case give us an even stronger sense of it. We must fight hard. These are from the Samaria region. We must fight hard for the land of Israel. We shouldn't give it to the Arabs. We must fight until the end. We must fight like crazy people. The youth who went to prison this week, it's heroism. We should act. There must be violence. Jews are taken out of their homes. A man with respect must fight for his home. Now, did you hear what I say? I hate those people. They're very important. Remember, the idea here is it's also a social networks idea. If you have connections with people, if they're your brothers or people you care about, you're not going to probably take a gun and shoot them in the head. But if you hate them, that makes the whole process a hell of a lot easier. If I hate someone, how do you think I should treat them? I feel cheated. I feel like they stole what is mine. How do you think I should feel? Being a good guy, we will take the gloves off. Now, what that says in some degree is our prediction, and it's an unfortunate prediction, is that in Samaria, there's probably going to be, if the government tries to do some of the same things it did in the Gaza Strip, the way things stand at the moment, most people probably will be removed rather peaceably. Most people are constrained by these counter norms, if you like. But there are larger groups of people that are not. And they showed up at least a number of times in our qualitative interviews and at least exist to some degree in our other interviews. Today, there's a growing a problem in Israel now with the settlers in Hebron, which is actually in Jabdaria, in Judea. We didn't look at them. But I was noticing the government's getting into a tit-tat with them, a kind of like, you know, us against you process with them. And at least from our work, it might suggest that might not work, might not be a good idea. Although it was raised in a presentation this morning, the question is, where is the boundary to try and resolve conflicts with people, as opposed to just saying, this is enough? Conclusions. We began with the question of why there was so little violence by settlers in the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. And our data show that settlers did strongly support ideologies that would justify and encourage violence. But our data also show that despite these ideologies, the settlers did not support actual violence against the army or government. In fact, defining this as cataclysmic, they said, no, you can't do that. No, that's not appropriate to do that. And we explain the lack of violence with a perspective of normative balance. Despite the radical ideologies of settlers, balancing norms related to Israeli society helped to constrain the reality of violence. And we also asked whether we might expect greater violence in future withdrawals, and our data suggests that there's less evidence of normative balance in the Samaria region, and that's not very good news, I don't think, for the Israeli government. Now, more generally, implications. Our study shows that violence by communities with radical ideologies can be strained by encouraging ties and contacts with the larger society. This approach of engagement and contact, moreover, appears to restrain violence even when support for the core ideologies of violence remain unchanged. And this is very important because what it says, right now, I think there's, at the U.S. Institute for Peace, they've been telling me this, the government has an orientation, we've got to change people's beliefs. Well, it's not very easy to change people's beliefs. Beliefs are hard things to change. What our study suggests is that you don't have to change people's beliefs necessarily. You can create, if you like, a set of counter-beliefs that helps to constrain the problems of violence. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, David, and Hagit, for your work. We're now moving to the third region of the world that we're going to cover this afternoon, which is South Africa. He was kidding with me earlier how to say his name in native language. I'll try in English. Nkosazana Joseph-Sande is an advocate of the High Court of South Africa in the Eastern Cape Provincial Division of Grahamstown. He was appointed by former President Nelson Mandela to South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where he served on the Committee for Human Rights Violations. As a member of the Human Rights Violations Committee, he helped prepare cases for public hearings, declared deponents as victims in terms of the Truth and Reconciliation Act. He also, during that tenure, voted on whether applicants would be extended or denied amnesty during the TRC proceedings. He's also used his expertise with the Truth and Reconciliation process in South Africa to advise on legislative efforts in Rwanda following the genocide there in 1994. And he spoke at several human rights conferences in Zimbabwe as well, clearly a man who's become a treasured asset in South Africa and Africa more generally. Mr. Sande.
Good afternoon. Chairperson, organizers of the symposium, ladies and gentlemen, I must thank you for giving us as South Africans the opportunity to come and participate in the proceedings of this symposium. I do not really regard myself as an expert on the question of a community policing or any question relating to the police as such. But I think there are several factors in my life that qualify me to talk on an issue of this nature. I grew up in an area where there was a lot of repression of people by the police during the apartheid era in my country. And when I finished at university, I worked for an NGO that was Lawyers for Human Rights, and I was again exposed to quite a number of situations where the police would do terrible things to people. And that made me, especially when I was still a young boy, to have a very profound a hatred and a fear for the police. That was before 1994. But later, with the establishment of the Truth Commission in South Africa, I was one of the people who were appointed by the new government to serve on this commission, which I reluctantly joined. I had a lot of reservations about a commission that was going to consider the possibility of giving a pardon to people who had committed such atrocities. But later, as I sat in those panels listening to stories from victims initially, and later listening to perspective of perpetrators, stories from perpetrators, my whole attitude changed, because I began to realize how bad our society was and how it could change people and make them terrible human beings. Now, there are certain facts which I think I should give you about South Africa, because I think there are many myths about South Africa. But before I give you those facts, let me first explain to you how we're going to present our submission to this symposium, myself and my colleague. I will give a general, some sort of a historical picture of what happened in South Africa. And my colleague will deal more in depth and comprehensively with community policing. Now, in my submission or my talk, I will tell you very briefly about the problems we have to transform the police into an effective policing mechanism that can protect our democracy. Because I'm sure you will all agree that the police are a very important institution in any society to keep that society going. If it is a democratic society, the police play an important role to keep that democracy going. But if that society is an oppressive society, the police, you will find that they will be used by the powers that be to maintain that system. Now, that is what was happening in my country before 1994. When the ANC won the elections, and for the first time we had universal suffrage in the country, where everyone had a right to vote. And for black people, it was the first time that they had a right to vote and elect a government of their choice. Now, why am I saying all these things? The theme of this conference, the theme of this symposium, rather, is listening to the world, new ideas for resolving identity-based conflict. And I have chosen the following topic as my talk, or as the basis of my talk today. That is where I say the changing role and image of the police under the new dispensation, in an attempt to share with you my ideas as to how politics can impact positively or negatively sometimes on policing, and what the police have to do in their day-to-day operations. Obviously, before I say that, see, I must confess that I'm a very bad speaker who will prepare a speech and never want to follow it. Then I end up being a very bad speaker. Now, South Africa has got a population of 46.9 people. We've got 150,000 police. We've got 11 official languages, and that is English and Afrikaans included. Some of you will be aware that Afrikaans is a simplification of Dutch. It's a South African Dutch. Now, we've got those languages. We are a multi-religious, multicultural, multi-class, several classes society, but we do not have an ethnic conflict, racial conflict, religious conflict, or anything of that kind. After 1994, the problems we are dealing with in South Africa are socio-economic problems. One speaker this morning, I think it was Michelle Alexander, she made an input which I found very impressive, where she was talking about the structure of the society, which you cannot ignore when you're dealing with police issues. In particular, the fact that in any society you'll have people who've been marginalized from the mainstream of the economy. Now, in South Africa, those people are African people. You get the poor of the poor in South Africa from amongst the African people, or to put it differently, the indigenous peoples of the country. So we may not have these things, ethnic conflict, religious conflict, and all those things, racial conflict and all that, but it does not mean that we are a society of social justice. And the current president of South Africa, the previous president as well, Nelson Mandela, would hardly finish any speech without referring to that situation of many people who are very poor in the country. Now, these are the issues the police have to deal with, because from time to time, you'll find that people will hold marches, they will protest, complaining about this and that, and the police that we have today, who were there, many of them, they were there even before 94, will be unable to deal with that situation, because let me tell you what, in the past, the profession of a policeman was regarded as a low job, a job for any Humpty Dumpty to do, especially amongst whites. It was regarded as Afrikaners in particular. The job of a policeman was regarded as a job for the poor, for the poor whites who had no education at all, full of racial bigotry, and they would use their positions in the police force to vent out their hatred for black people in the country. And even those black people who were there in the police force had no proper elementary education. Many of them did not even have driver's licenses. I think it is fair to say that the first requirement to join the police in the old South Africa was to be able to torture a suspect, to get the truth out of the suspect by means of a torture. Now, my colleague will deal extensively with those issues. But I must say, sorry, I must apologize, I've got flu, and I'm thirsty. Thank you. But I must say that when the new government took over in 1994, they were very much aware of these problems. In fact, even in the interim constitution, a provision was made for transformation of the police. We had 11 ethnic homelands under the apartheid system. Our political masters, our previous political masters, had this idea that you could have a homeland within South Africa for the Xhosa people, for the Zulus, for the Sotus, for the Botswana, and so on and so on. Now, in that way, they divided the country into various Bantustans. Now, these Bantustans, some of them were given independence, what was regarded by some of us as Mickey Mouse independence. They were given this independence, they would have their own police forces, with the result that in 1994, you had 11 police forces in the country, which had to be integrated with the South African police. The government decided to form one national police service. In fact, the name was changed from South African Police Force to South African Police Service. Emphasis changed from the use of force and intimidation to service. Today in South Africa, we speak of the South African Police Service and not the South African Police Force, which is what we used to have in the past. But the memories of people, the memories in the minds of many people are still very much alive. Memories of what the police used to do in the past. And although people have kind of accepted the new police service as a vehicle for the protection and defense of the new democratic system, they find it difficult to fully accept the new police service. People will tell you that in principle, we're prepared to work with the police. In principle, we're prepared to work with the police, but you'll find that in practice, people will not cooperate with the police because they still regard working with the police as an act of being a sellout. But I must say there are those people in certain areas who have accepted the police without any reservation. Yeah. But now you must remember that this is a police service which is not really, it's not a normal police service. It has got all the problems which I've mentioned, the problems of corruption, inability to do proper investigations. But I must also say that sometimes when I do cases in court, I come across young members of our police service who actually make me feel very proud about being South African. I'm talking about police officers who can do their work very well, people who are very courteous, very passionate about their job, you know, hardworking people. I've come across those. I'm trying to say to you, if I were to give a description of what I have to say to you today, it's a combination of both positive and negative. When I had to prepare my talk, I told myself that I was not going to come and theorize here. I said I must go out and talk to people who are actually in the police service, and some of them were police officers even during the apartheid era. Some of them had actually arrested me when I was a political activist. But I have no hesitation to say that when I was talking to these people, trying to find out how they feel about being a policeman in the new South Africa and so on, I had no hesitation that These people have really changed. They have changed. They want to be part of the crowd that is going to make South Africa a success. I also spoke with people who are intimately involved with community policing structures, and I interviewed people from people in general, in public, members of the public, about community policing. And the picture I got was that people are prepared to work with the police in South Africa, but there are these problems, which my friend is going to say a lot about. When I was preparing this paper, I also asked myself if there are any similarities between South Africa and America, because I'm sure those who invited South Africans had a purpose for doing so. They wanted to learn something from us, in the same way that we are also going to learn something from this symposium. Now, I try to look at what the similarities are, and it would seem to me that there are more similarities between South Africa, notwithstanding the negative, the problems I've mentioned about the police in South Africa, but there are many similarities between South Africa and America. Although I'm not trying to pretend to know the history of America very well, but from the little I know, there's quite a few similarities, which I would be careful not to emphasize, because each country will always have its own peculiarities. Countries are never exactly the same, but in general there will be similarities. And I think one of the major similarities is that in both countries in the past, the blacks have not been treated fairly. Both countries in the past practiced racial segregation in the areas of education, in residence, employment. And you had a situation in both countries in the past where one's enjoyment of rights depended entirely on his skin. Now, in America, this gave rise to the civil rights movement, which was led by the late Dr. Martin Luther. And in South Africa, this gave rise to a situation where Nelson Mandela was the leader of a mass democratic struggle, which eventually was resolved in 1994. Both countries have very beautiful constitutions with bills of rights. There's a lot of emphasis on the liberty of the individual, the rule of law, property rights, and so on. But they both have a problem of a number of people who've been marginalized from the mainstream of the economy. And I think that is a source of many problems that are faced by the police in both countries. And I fully align myself with some of the submissions that were made by one of the speakers this morning. And I want to add that the individual policeman is not intentionally a racist, but he's caught up in a society that has got its own prejudices to certain groups. And I also believe that the way the police behave will in many cases reflect the type of society in which they operate. To put it bluntly, you can never have a non-racist policeman you can never have a policeman who thinks democratically in an undemocratic society. In many ways, when you look at the behavior, the conduct of the police, that will reflect what is happening in that society. Finally, I think the main difference between South Africa and America is that, sorry, Mr. Chairman, once again. The main difference between South Africa and America is that in America, you've not had a process of national cleansing like the one that we had in South Africa, the Truth Commission, which has made South Africa to be what it is today. But I'm not going to suggest to the people of America that they should have a TRC here, or they should have a process similar to the TRC. That is a matter for the Americans to decide. Thank you, Chairperson. I thank you.
No, you're fine. It's fine. Thank you very much. Sikeleu has taken us into South Africa and given us a picture of a police force that he believes is in the process of changing. Gareth Newham is going to take us deeper into that same police force. He's a project manager at the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation in South Africa, where he's responsible for overseeing and implementing policing projects for the center's criminal justice program. He's presently managing projects that enhance civilian oversight and police accountability, that tackle corruption and promote police integrity, understand diversity and the transformation of the South African police services, and the metropolitan policing and improving witness management programs. Since 2000, Mr. Newham has assisted the South African police services at a multiple of levels with strategic planning processes, and he's been a trainer on the European Union-funded police station management program on issues of leadership and performance management. He's developed policy proposals for the establishment of investigation units and witness protection programs for South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and as a result, Gareth was appointed into a multidisciplinary team that was tasked with establishing South Africa's first witness protection program. So without further ado, Gareth Newham.
Thank you very much. Let you get my PowerPoint presentation. I come from an organization called the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation. As you've heard, it was established in 1989 with the primary goal of looking at the causes and effects of state-sponsored violence on the various communities of South Africa. The police were then used primarily to enforce the racist apartheid laws, and were seen at that stage by most South Africans, more than 80% surely, as the enemy. And over the past decade or so, we've seen some dramatic changes in South Africa. Firstly, I think one indicator, positive indicator, is the crime has reduced. It's starting to reduce quite dramatically. Our most accurate indicator is murder, and we've dropped from 67 murders per 100,000 to 40 murders per 100,000, the most recent crime statistics at the end of last year. On top of that, we've seen incredible improvements in the public's attitude towards police. During the late 1990s, there were a number of national surveys which showed that just over 30% of the population of South Africa were satisfied with policing in the areas. By 2000, we started seeing a majority of South Africans saying that. And importantly, black South Africans as a variable group showing a higher appreciation of policing in their suburbs. The question I want to ask, or just debate a bit today, is to what extent can we credit community policing for this? Since community policing was seen as the fundamental way that the South African police service was going to be transformed, from a force that served the interests of a few and oppressed the majority to a service serving the interests of everybody and looking after the interests of communities. To give you some background, as I said, the police were seen as the enemy. It was really in 1990, with the release of Nelson Mandela from prison and the unbanning of the various liberation movements, that a process of negotiation towards democracy started. However, in that time, there was incredible violence. In the early 90s, between 1990 and 1993, we had something like 10,000 people killed in political violence, particularly in the provinces of Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal. as various groupings started trying to jostle for power and influence in the new democracy. This led to the signing of the National Peace Accord. The police were deeply implicated in taking sides in this violence. They were clearly against the previous liberation movements and were supporting some of the proxy forces that they were using to try and divide communities in the 1980s. So a new policing National Police Accord was signed in 1991, and community policing was for the first time used in South Africa as a term to try and describe a way that policing should be undertaken. This is obviously more than a decade after community policing was quite well known in most of the Western world. However, between 1991 July and June 1992, the police killed 518 people while policing public order, disorder marches, and so forth like that. We had democracy in 1994, and a program of comprehensive police reform started happening. Pretty much the constitution changed, we had a new constitution, there's a Bill of Rights, the entire legislative and policy framework for the policing changed, new recruitment standards, new training, new uniforms, painted the vehicles different colors, restructured the way the police is organized, called the ranks by different names, and started trying to create this notion we need to work towards a service. And initially there was a lot of focus on police accountability. Under apartheid, the police were really unaccountable. There was no comeback. Torture, as was mentioned by my colleague earlier, and violence was the way that policing was undertaken against people who were threatening apartheid or resisting apartheid. So a lot of focus of our constitutional drafters and policymakers was about how do you bring the police under democratic control. So we saw a civilian-led ministry of safety and security, which was to oversee the police force itself, its budget and so forth. We had parliament. A portfolio committee on safety and security was to hold the executive accountable on how they spent that budget and how policing was undertaken. We had independent structures, such as the Independence Complaints Directorate, which were a civilian-led organization to investigate all deaths as a result of police action or in custody and any other cases of complaints against the police. And we had Chapter 9 institutions, Chapter 9 of our constitution, such as the Public Protector, the Human Rights Commission, Gender Commission, which were also able to investigate complaints against the police. So we see community policing in the early stages really very much focusing on the issue of accountability, local level accountability. And the idea was that the police were responsible for making sure that every one of the 1,200 police stations that were scattered around South Africa had a community policing forum. These forums were supposed to be representative of the local community, they would elect an executive, and they would then be a place in which the police, management of a police station, and representatives of the community could talk about the community's needs, and to be able to make sure that the police were actually responding to the community's needs. So there's a very strong focus on oversight of the police, monitoring of police behavior and service delivery at the local level. Boards are formed at an area level, a district level, and then there was a provincial level. We have 9 provinces in South Africa. So that's how the structure was sort of looked at, and information would flow between those levels. And at that stage, really, CPS was seen as the key structure, the forum for making sure that community policing was going to work, to make sure that the police were forced by law to talk to the various communities they were supposed to be policing. And however, what we start seeing in the policy documents, and I'll do a quick policy review now, is that all the policies that talk about community policing actually talk about the functions of community policing forums. They don't really talk about the way the police should be structured or trained to deal with community policing and community services. Really, it was about specific police individuals, officers being assigned to go and attend community policing forums, and all the policies start talking about what these community policing forums should try and achieve. Now, as I say, initially it starts with, as you've seen the policy review, it starts with a clear focus on the police accountability, and over time, as crime started really getting out of control in the mid-1990s, and it was a huge concern in South Africa, it was on the top concerns on most national surveys of all citizens, they start focusing slightly different on what they think community policing should be about. So if you look at community policing policy, we see in the very interim constitution talking about oversight of police through monitoring evaluation. We have a new minister in 94, and in 95 he says that community policing should pervade the entire organization, and he adds on an issue that police community relations and information is important, liaison. We then see guidelines published in 1997 by the Ministry of Safety and Security that oversee the police, and they add on this issue about partnerships, that police should form partnerships with the communities. And they start moving away a bit from accountability and oversight monitoring. And that comes from a new approach that the government had taken in 1996 about trying to deal with crime in South Africa through a developmental and holistic approach. We had the National Crime Prevention Strategy, which looked at building partnerships between the state, between civil society and private organizations, and making sure that the organizations, the various departments of the state, were working more closely together, both at the spheres, in other words, local level, provincial level, and national level departments, but also the various departments themselves, bringing in the education department, the health department, social welfare, and so forth. How could we all play a role? And then we see in 1998 that the 98 white paper on safe and security says that local government should really start driving crime prevention programs, and they should mobilize and use community policing forums to get community members involved in these programs. A bit later, there's a move upwards because of weaknesses at local level. They say, well, we need to have a multi-agency community safety forums where provincial governments and higher-level government departments can meet together to help assist with solving community crime problems. However, by 2003, that doesn't seem to be working, so they go back down to a more localized approach and say, right, we're having sector policing is now the new expression of community policing, and therefore we're going to break up the precincts, as 1,200 precincts, into five geographical areas each and assign more officers to what's seen as community policing. It's not too surprising that evaluations of community policing in South Africa from about 2000 onwards starts finding that they don't really have much reach. Part of the problem is this constant changing about what community policing forums are supposed to do and what their functions are supposed to be. And this is causing a lot of confusion. And you see a huge variety of the way that various community police forums start acting. You see that only 45% of citizens nationally even know what a community policing forum is. So most South Africans actually still haven't even heard of a community policing by 2003, 2004. And research we did in 2004 in Johannesburg amongst 3,600 station or local-based police officers who are directly responsible for policing various communities. Less than half of them had even attended a community policing forum meeting in the previous year. So this leads to some reflection on what are the kind of challenges that are being faced. From the police's side, you start seeing that the police actually see community policing as an add-on. It's certain officers do it, but not all officers. So only those that are appointed to community policing forums or those that are appointed to sector forums, they do community policing, but detectives don't do it, crime intelligence doesn't do it, the average patrol officer who doesn't attend meetings don't see themselves as doing something called community policing. So there's no real training around community policing, there's no real restructuring of the organization to undertake what is seen as community policing. And partly because of these changes in policy, the organization itself wasn't able to kind of keep up with it. They had a transformation process that they were just carrying on with, which is more about professional policing and service delivery rather than community policing, ultimately. Also, there's still police organizational culture and structure that mitigates against working with communities. Some police officers really still believe that policing crime is actually a professional's job, the dark side of the community. If we actually listen to the needs of the communities, we'll be allowing vigilantism. Sometimes the communities want us to go and beat people up and use torture. They want us to be hard against criminals, and we can't. We're governed by the Bill of Rights. You also have these issues around performance management. It's a national policing agency, and the national policing agency structure says, right, we want to reduce contact crimes by 7% in the next year, and that breaks down into very specific targets for every single police station command in the country about reducing contact crimes. And some police stations and some policing areas in the rural areas, contact crimes aren't a serious problem, but maybe stock theft is a problem, or house burglary when people aren't there, car theft. Those might be local problems that the community policing forums are trying to force the police to respond to. But the station commissioner, unless he puts extra resources and gets arrests for contact crimes, he's going to be failing in his target. So you see community needs at odds with national policy. And then the government doesn't really actually, although there's been a debate about this in South Africa and there's a consensus amongst those of us in the NGOs that because it's a constitutionally defined structure, it's in legislation that they have to provide finances for it, very little money is actually coming to these structures. So they're operating without budgets. They really rely on the community resources, and South Africa really has a huge inequality situation in terms of wealth. Some communities are incredibly poor, and they can't actually provide resources other than time to promote these structures. And then, of course, because of this change in policy, you just have various interpretations, and some of them are contradictory. Some people say, right, we're going to take the partnership approach. Typically wealthier communities or more established communities who didn't have such a bad relationship with the police, often formerly white communities, are more likely to come in there, raise funds, try and buy computers, extra cars, police radios, and try and assist policing in fighting crime. Communities that had a very negative experience with police start still focusing on the oversight role. They want to see how the police are behaving. They see the community forums as ways of raising complaints, concerns about brutality, lack of service delivery, slow response times, corruption. And in those community forums, the relationship is incredibly antagonistic. The police, because it's a national organization, say, look, we answer to our boss. We answer to our seniors. We don't answer to the community. And so you have different communities where they're still, where the community policing forum is actually antagonistic, whereas in other situations they actually have quite close partnerships. But they're doing different things because of this change in policy. From the community side, there's still a lack of, as I said now, many communities don't trust the police, or certainly throughout the, up until 2000. Corruption is a serious problem for many people. The issue of who is representing community interests on a community policing forums. You'll find that many times you'll have quite organized, strong groups, such as taxi associations, and many of them actually legal, a little more than crime syndicates, actually hire assassins to take out rival taxi associations. Similar to the paramilitary stuff mentioned in Northern Ireland, are always on the, you know, in many places are on the community police forums to make sure that they are able to push their interests, to get organized crime groups that actually start hijacking these structures, because they want to be able to make connections with the police. They want to know when the, you know, what the crime stats are, what are the police's capacity in that area. So community forums start getting hijacked by different interest groups. And often it's the most marginal and most vulnerable people who are the least organized with the least voice who actually aren't on these community policing forums that are able to make sure the police are serving their needs. And once again, the wealth really makes a huge difference. We see some research definitely showed that the wealthier the community, the more likely the community policing forum was to actually provide positive information, partnerships, and responsiveness to the community's needs. But often those wealthier communities also have private security, high walls, electric fences, and so forth, and don't need the same kind of policing services that the poorer communities are in more antagonistic relationships need from the police. So in conclusion, I think you can see that there's been a policy change in South Africa around community policing. It's incredibly difficult to gauge whether community policing as a policy approach has actually really improved the relationship between the police or even the crime situation. In fact, there's no evidence to suggest that. It is more likely that other programs of reform related to the South African Police Service, such as aggressive affirmative action policies to ensure that the police represent the communities they serve, much better training and recruitment standards. New police members coming now have to have a driver's license, they have to finish high school, they can't have criminal records. Something like in 1994, 20,000 police officers had criminal records in South Africa. They have to be literate. Up to 25% of South African police members in 1994 could not read or write. 60% did not have driver's licenses. So they could not provide services to people. So you've seen those changes really changing the nature and structure of the police agency, and it's more likely that is actually causing, those issues are really actually changing the relationships as opposed to community policing. And so effective and consistent community policing in South Africa remains an ongoing challenge. When I say an ongoing challenge, it's still being recognized, and it's interesting because there are a lot of different kinds of initiatives around the country that are still being taken place. Some local governments are starting to try and fund the community policing forums. There's a whole way of trying to get volunteers through community policing forums to do joint patrols of the police or to at least start assisting the police by providing victim empowerment services and so forth. So there's still a very inconsistent approach to community policing throughout the country, but it's certainly still seen as a kind of key policy approach, and people are still trying to work towards it. I'm going to stop there because I think rather we can take questions, and hopefully I'll be able to answer any questions you have specifically about that. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank all the panelists for staying very much on time. I need to check with our directors over here. Should we go another 15 minutes or what?
I should, like, 5 minutes.
5 minutes? Okay. Jeffrey Parker in the back.
I understand my role is to repeat some of this question so that those listening in the webcast and the like will hear it. And I can't do justice to Jeffrey's eloquent question, but it essentially is that the insignias of difference are everywhere. The societies are deeply polarized and have been for a long time. The Orange Order is not a minor exception to the Parades Commission, and consequently, while he's impressed by the achievement, he wants to ask the panel if they are underestimating the problem ahead. Can people answer from the seat, or do they come back up here? Why don't you, who would like to take a crack at this to see whether you're underestimating or how you would react to this? Anyone?
I would just very briefly say on the situation in Northern Ireland is that what I would like to see is people taking a longer term policy view over change, because change does take time, and you're right about the Orange Order not engaging. Well, you're right and wrong. The Orange Order doesn't officially engage with the Parades Commission, just as Republicans and Sinn Féin don't talk to the police, only they all do. You know, and they find ways. There's been probably more Orange men going into the Parades Commission than anybody else, but they go in as Unionist councillors, DUP councillors, and all this sort of way. And I would just say I agree with what you said. I would just like policymakers to give some of these things time, because they do need time. And I'm interested by what you say, Gareth, the amount of changes that every year and a half around community policing. It means sometimes as a researcher doing it, you almost have no ability to judge it, because the policies are changing so quickly. So one thing I would say is that if one's looking to change how community police relationships take place, how processes of mediation might bed in, you do need time to see how these can work.
Another question?
I'm just going to give a comment that one problem with overgeneralization is it leads to oversimplification. And I think that there's my talk wasn't at all about the kind of structural inequalities and other issues that also exist in Israeli societies. They do in other societies. I suspect our first lecture this morning talked about a gigantic structural set of inequalities in the United States, which is right in the backyard. So I think that it's very easy to talk about societies and to sort of brand them. And being in a panel, you know, if these are places, hot spots of conflict, you might say. But the complexities and the differences can often be important. Now, of course, as someone once said to me when I said, well, that's like apples and oranges, and they said, well, they're both fruit. You know, there are obviously generalizations that are important, but I think it's also important to step back a bit and to look at each of these problems, each of the different sort of problems within their context, and not try to oversimplify.
I very much agree. Number of programs to address in the ocean given.
Yes. Let me read the question. The question is about political leadership and its role, particularly in the Israeli withdrawal.
If Shimon Peres would have tried to do the same thing that Sharon did, there would have been a lot more problems. And one of the reasons I suspect there was, and first of all, you can't disentangle the issue of charisma. A person has a long career, etc. Peres also has much of that. But one of the reasons I think that it went perhaps as smoothly as it did is that Sharon is known as someone who's quite sympathetic to these people. He knows them very well. They know him. They know, even though they talked a lot of him being a turncoat and an enemy, they still know him well and knew that he's a supporter. So that everybody believes, if you want, you might say that Sharon's heart was in the place of understanding, of having a sense of what their issues were and what their voices were. And his campaign of withdrawal was also built that way. The head of the Withdrawal Commission was a guy who was a religious Jew who had many commonalities with the settlers. So it might have played a role like that. Of course, it might have just been that Sharon is a very powerful personality in Israeli politics, of which there was no one else nearly as powerful in terms of getting anything done.
I guess we have time for one more. Yes, in the back. There are two questions, and they'll be the last for this session. One has to do with whether or not people believe there's been a change in beliefs that underlie the violence and the conflict, or a change in strategy in a more instrumental sense. And a second, a question about their analysis of the role religion is playing. The question asks, is it playing more of a instigative role to violence, or one that delays violence because of confidence that retribution will come another day? Is anyone?
It's very hard to answer a question like that because it's very hard to know. What I'd say is that the fact that they don't voice support for violence is a general issue, suggests that it's not just a strategic kind of question. It's interesting, though, one of the biggest strategies developed in Gaza was a policy called panim al panim, which means face to face. And they were very committed to this idea that if they just spoke to other Israelis face to face, if they went to every door, the people would understand that this was the wrong thing to do. Now, I suspect that also suggests the way in which they view other Israelis like them. They're like me, and if I just have a chance to give my argument, maybe they'd come across to mine. In terms of religion, I think the problem is that Judaism, unlike Christianity a bit, is not as kind of forgiving or as, and I don't know about Islam, but is not sort of, you know, to take a back step, retribution will come from God. I would say it's more that if we're right, then God will be on our side, and then retribution will come. So in this case, I don't think religion played a constraining kind of element in terms of saying, well, you know, in the next world they'll get it. The importance of this sort of movement is very committed to what happens in this world. In this world you will get redemption, not in the next world.
Anyone else? All right. I want to thank all of our panelists for very interesting and enlightening presentations. I want to thank all of you for coming. Before I surrender the podium, I especially want to thank Laura Widener and Michael Spencer. I've been in lots of conferences, and this is clearly one of the best organized from every conceivable angle. So I'm very appreciative of the job the journal has done and that Laura and Michael have done. I also want to thank Nancy Rogers, who has made this collaboration between the law school and the Mershon Center possible. And Nancy will preside over the next and last session, which will start in 5-minute break. So thank you all very much.
Right, we're ending at 5. Yes. Pleasure to introduce two additional people, as well as to reintroduce those you've already heard from, to allow some questions from you, so keep these in mind, and to ask some more questions of our panelists as we end this wonderful conference. First, introduce Kathy Constantino. Kathy has both a master's in social work and a law degree, and has been a leader in the area of systems design. She's taught in a number of universities, including Georgetown, George Washington University, Columbia, many others. But also she has, as both in her employment and in a consulting capacity, done systems design for the federal government agencies, for the United Nations, within other countries, such as the Canadian police, and is the co-author of a wonderful book on dispute system design. Jackie Nolan Haley is a professor at Fordham Law School. She has done a variety of work in what would be called overall legal ethical issues in dispute resolution, a great book that is an extensive overview of those issues. But in addition, Jackie was a real pioneer in working with people in Northern Ireland in sharing back and forth ideas on how dispute system design might help in a variety of ways to heal rifts and to move forward policy agendas, bringing about agreement among people. So it's a wonderful couple of designers to be joined with to ask some questions of the panel at the end. I'm going to begin this with a hypothetical so that we can really focus on a future agenda. And that is, I'd like you to assume that I'm a lot wealthier than I am, and I am a philanthropist, and that I'm willing to spend $5 million a year on an idea if I think it's good enough. And that idea might be some conflict resolution approach to community policing in this country. Now, what I would like to invest in is something that would both move the agenda forward in terms of equality of treatment by police of people in a variety of identity groups, and also something that would reduce the rift that policing has caused among those groups. So it's a dual agenda. I have another requirement of this proposal before I will fund it, and that is this, that it needs to be a prototype of something that would keep going and be expanded, would be sustainable without my $5 million a year thereafter. So it's a 10-year start, basically $50 million, if you think it's worth my spending the money and can persuade me that it would both reduce the inequality of police treatment among identity-based groups and reduce the rifts among those groups. Now, as the philanthropist, I don't mean it has to solve the problems. The problems, I'm assuming, are in this country, as you have mentioned, in other countries, long-term and deep. I'm only asking for an improvement. So beginning with that, let me just ask to start out with some preliminary questions, and then I'm going to ask my colleagues to ask some design questions to see if I think it's going to come up to the level of something worth providing that funding. And the first is for those of you who are on panels from this country, to ask you, having listened to the international panel, knowing that there are situations of inequality in those countries as well as our own, and that police community relations have been troublesome there too, but having heard about some of the structures that were put in place, changed, improved, and some positive results, whether there is the seed of an idea that you have heard that you might suggest as the beginning of what might be a proposal to me for the $50 million. And Jay, I'm going to ask that you start that process and start with an idea that I might find attractive.
Okay, so I get the first crack at $50 million. Wow.
Can I have a car?
First, to start domestic, indeed an independent source of funding that could be brought to cities and invite them, therefore, to invest in or explore something creative, I think would be a great jump start. In fact, the several projects that I've done where cities have been faced with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in settlement costs for litigation, they've been very resistant to invest thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in exploring alternative dispute approaches because they don't have enough experience and that's not how they're conditioned to have to spend money. So if money could come from a foundation to catalyze their interest, I think that could go a long way. In terms of what I learned from some of the international panelists, I think the two things I'd focus on is, in David's talk, the notion of focusing on the intra-group conflicts, that is, the conflicts within the communities, so within the policing community, within the minority communities, perhaps, before we bring them together, I think could be an important first step, that an awful lot of times there are great problems going on within institutions that are then played out across the institutions, or within groups that are then played out across the groups. I'm afraid we're probably seeing that in Israel and Palestine today, with Hamas seemingly trouncing Fatah, not so much because of Hamas's international policy, but rather because of Hamas's domestic approach that has won favor among the Palestinians. So in other words, the notion of intergroup conflict resolution, police-community conflict resolution, probably has to start with more focus on police-police relations and community-community relations. So that's one point. The second one, listening to the speakers from Northern Ireland, is just the power of symbols and how much the thin blue line means, what police identity is, and the extent to which, if we're going to get them as partners in a collaborative problem-solving issue approach, how much we have to give credence and credibility to what each community finds its dignity in and its identity through. So I guess I'd ask this philanthropist to help us both develop models for helping groups bridge the gaps within their own sides and also recognize the powerful symbolism of how they express and promote their own identities in their interactions with each other.
Move to those of you who are on the international panel. You first heard a lot about the problems in the United States, and you heard first that there are some kinds of conflict resolution processes that deal with individual conflicts, and then the work that was done to try to build on those to develop a dialogue beyond that, and then the efforts to bring in the community and then to ask the community comments to be given to something of a settlement group to actually implement. But as you thought about what you've seen develop in your own countries, would you recommend that some of the processes you're using be processes that are candidates for the $50 million? Nick, what about the forums?
Well, what I would recommend, what I've seen and thought that has worked the best in Northern Ireland and a few things I've seen in South Africa, you've got inequalities of power when the police are meeting communities, and you've got to find ways of overcoming it. Very often money that's flown through from the state still goes through the policing institutions. What it seems to me is a part of a mediative process is
developing resources and skills within those communities that when that police community meeting takes place, that they're able to, that the community are therefore able to deliver on the things that the police are going to ask them. And let me give you one very, very small example, which I would describe as a mediative process, although it doesn't sound like it. Around the problems with parades, there's been lots of negotiations and attempts at mediation. One of the obvious problems was that when the organisers of the parades came to some sort of agreement, they often couldn't deliver on it precisely because they didn't have the skills to manage the parade. All right. So there was then started a project where they trained people in the parading organisations, and this is something we nicked off South Africa during the peace process. We even took the manuals, that the training manuals that South Africans used, a project to train stewards and marshals around the parades. Now, that's not going to solve the problem in itself, but that project empowered people within the parading community so that when they started meeting with the police, they were meeting on much more equal terms and they could deliver on the sort of arrangement. So if I was looking to utilize a large amount of money, I think I would be looking at projects which work within the community to raise the capacity of those communities to deliver on the new relationships.
Siki, let me ask you, would you recommend the police community forums to this country?
Africa, precisely because of what has just been mentioned now by Dominique. I think what we had is to build on what he was saying, not only was there a problem within the community forums that are being representing communities, they weren't all representing the entire community, and they weren't able to deliver on what the police expected from them. We had the same problem with the police not being able to expect what the community wanted. So, as I said, community policing was an add-on. There would be certain officers that were community policing officers who would attend these meetings. But if the problem was slow investigations or inadequate feedback from investigators at a police station, there's nothing that officer could do to force the detectives to change. So I would think that you would need to have agree with this sort of intra-community approach where you start looking at who's in that community, which can you profile the kinds of groups within those communities that have been policed by a certain precinct and the way that they are seeing the relationships of the police. Because clearly you might have, as we have in South Africa, you might have very strong relationships between the shop owners, business owners, and the police, and very weak relationships between the residents or youth groups, or you know, that kind of thing, or people representing homeless or refugees and so forth. So you need to actually go into those various, identify those various communities, do the kind of capacity building, the training, get the kind of stories, the problems that they're facing. And then I think you need a much higher engagement from the police themselves. When it's not just enough to respond to those issues at a very local level, but they've got to actually take that information, those challenges, and say, well, let's, from the police's side, evaluate, are we training our police officers in a way that might address some of these problems? Are the way we're managing the, you know, our frontline supervisors looking out for the following behaviors? How do they respond to some of these problems that we're hearing? So you need to get an approach and a buy-in from the police that show that if they can improve their relationships with these communities, they can actually address crime more better, have better relationships. It's more safer for the police themselves, especially in high-risk or violent areas. But that requires them to really be a bit more kind of circumspect and reflective on the culture, the management systems, performance management systems, the way they're trained. It's got to be a bit bigger than just sort of a specific group and a specific police station.
Thank you. Now, let me just move quickly to Jackie and Kathy and ask if you think there's the nugget of an idea here that might make me release the $50 million.
I think there's lots of nuggets, Nancy. I'm trying to decide who's going to get the money here. I'd like to push a couple of ideas that we heard this morning to see who gives me the answer I like so we can dole out this money. One of the themes that seemed to be consistent this morning was the idea of dialogue, and that seemed to continue this afternoon into consensus forums, the public forums. But I wonder about the limits of dialogue and the limits of these forums. Gareth, you spoke about in South Africa sometimes the, when we want to acknowledge community voice, but sometimes the community wants you to engage in torture, for example. Dominic, you spoke about the dark side of community, the exclusion community as an exclusionary device. So I guess I would ask both of you in thinking about this, how should community norms be decided, and what would be some design principles to help us think about, I guess it goes to whose voice matters, but how should we decide about community norms? Who makes those decisions? This will be in the training manual.
Well, one of the difficult but important things is that in a democratic society you have elected representatives, and so that I do think that, and I know that there's often problems in communities with the nature of elected representatives, but I do think that those processes are healthy things. But there are an awful lot and a very good sort of deliberative devices that can be done that democratic organizations do. And, you know, a number of organizations in the US have been ahead of the game in organizing these things, where you can find ways of linking communities and getting at those spaces and place and people that we often don't manage to get to. So, I mean, I would say that those people, experts in deliberative democracy, have probably much to say in how you do those. I mean, I agree with you, Jackie, about some of the problems with the dialogue thing, but I do think there are processes that can be learned for to achieve that sort of thing.
Gareth is going to finish.
Just to quickly answer I think in South Africa, our challenge is to how do you get communities to adopt the norms and values in the Constitution? Because we do come from a very divided and fractured past, and there are various norms and values in different communities that are actually at odds with the Constitution, and what we're trying to do is actually build those values and norms from the Constitution. They become the fundamental building block for what we'd like to see all South Africans starting to embrace and adopt. And some interesting research that's been taken in South Africa is that, you know, something like 75% of South Africans approve of the death penalty, but our Constitutional Court has ruled it unconstitutional due to the clause, which is the right to life. Now, they've done research where they've just asked the question, so if somebody has been caught for armed robbery and shot somebody dead, should that person get a death penalty? And I think at that level, 75% of the population will say yes. Then they give a little bit of information about the person's background, and they start, the more information they give about the person's background, the more options they give to address the problem from a developmental point of view. You're sort of seeing the reduction from 75% to somewhere around 42%, I think, where people still support the death penalty after they've thought through other possible options and realized what that means for themselves and how. And so what this kind of research was trying to look at was, when you give people more information about a certain, if you humanize the individual, you enrich or give them a much greater understanding of the complexity of people's lives and the way that you can address problems through a more developmental approach, looking at what causes people to commit crime and maybe addressing it at that level, support for these kind of radical alternatives starts dropping. So I think partly it would be about the dialogue, if you're going to use dialogue, is to really actually challenge the communities, saying, you know, you want to string people up and torture them, but, you know, what happens if it's your son or your father or somebody in your family, and what happens if they've had this background, and what happens if they would respond very well to this kind of intervention? Suddenly you start getting a dialogue which actually prompts thinking a bit more carefully and provokes people's reflection a bit more. And I think that's where dialogue could be a good thing, if it's trying to direct people towards a specific value, to try and get them to understand the importance of the constitutional values that you have in a society.
Directed dialogue, I like that. Good.
Yes. I think the biggest problem is that usually the police will have a different understanding of what a community policing is about, or what it ought to be about. And the community will have its own understanding of the concept. And I think really one should start off by ensuring that the two sides have got a common understanding of community policing, and that can be done by way of training workshops for the police as well as members of the community. But I think at the same time, you can set two different processes in motion at the same, going together at the same time. That is the first process where you're trying to improve the relationship between the police and the community, and the second process being the one where you focus mainly on the community to empower those people with the view to ultimately have a community courts in those communities where the people can resolve their own disputes where in cases where minor offenses have been committed. Yeah. And this has been done in South Africa. Thank you.
I'm going to call on you, Kathy, but before I want to mention to all of you that the audience is full of dispute designers and people who are real experts, and so the next question is going to go out to you. So be preparing for that question, Kathy.
Yes, I noticed some themes running through the day, and I have to say that if I were a philanthropist, I would, you know, think about what my goal was and what I wanted to achieve. And one of the things I noticed as we were going through the day is there's a bit of a time theme amongst everyone here. There are some of you that are dealing with issues that are based in the past. There are some of you that are dealing with issues that are based in the present. And there are some of you that are dealing with relationships and conflicts that are going to go into the future. And I think that that's a relatively important concept. I also notice some differences in architecture among what you have chosen and why you have chosen it and what you've learned from it. So my question would really be addressed to three people. For Sandy, I heard you say that you were dealing with really people's perceptions and people's fears, and I think I heard you say that third parties may or may not have been helpful, and that the models that you as a designer chose may or may not have been helpful. I think for Ray, I heard you talking about using a particular architecture to deal with things that had happened in the past that were trying to reach some form of resolution, not necessarily a healing, but a resolution. And so I would ask you to think about that. And for David, I heard you talk about prevention, but prevention of something that was going to happen in the future and whether there were any tools used. So the real question for each of you is, to what extent did the nature of the dispute affect the type of architecture that you chose, and if you had it to do again, would you choose differently? What would you do differently? Maybe we can start with Sandra.
Maybe I can weave the answer. Can you hear me? Maybe I can weave the answer to that question to also address the $50 million, since I can't sort of let that money float by here without. Well, first of all, I think that a lot of the projects that I've personally been involved with have come from my own stories, my own experiences, and that's a liability of being a psychologist, and I'm trying to get over that. So my first reaction to your request would be to say, now, who are the smartest people I know who think the most creatively, and I get them in the room and think with me on this. So let me think out loud about this just for a minute. $50 million could be divided in odd kinds of ways. It could be $1 million per state. That would be sort of a bad model, I think, but it's sort of interesting ideas. It could be we could take the notion that the world is flat, like Friedman talks about, although I think it's much more interesting to think about it in terms of transnational issues, and we have transregional issues. So we might think in terms of taking the money and allocating resources to regions that have their own unique special problems. The problem in the greater metropolitan DC area is probably not like what's going on in Seattle, for example. So I would want to think in terms of geography and regions. I'd want to think in terms of the work that I'm familiar with in terms of, I do a lot of work on gender and conflict, and so if you take that as an identity-based issue and translate it to policing, you could say, how do we mainstream? We know that gender mainstreaming works. So how does mainstreaming the issues of victims and potential victims into the decision-making processes, how could we get that to work? So I would design something in which, if we would use dialogues, which I think would be an essential component of the design, then I'd want to make sure that all the right players are in the room to be, have that conversation. I think with some with an opportunity that has those kinds of resources, it's an opportunity for us to really make a transformational change around thinking about policing in this country. And to that extent, I'd go for I'd go at the level of policy. I'd go at the level of structure. Someone said, you know, this is a democratic society. We have we have elected officials, but that, our elected officials actually leave out a whole group of people who feel very underrepresented or unrepresented. So I'd make sure that that group is also reflected in this. So as you see, I'm sort of thinking out loud, sort of there's a structural base, there's a regional base to this. There's the dialogue that actually does give a forum or a platform for people to raise their concerns. But then you'd need some really good implementers. I think the people who designed this conference, I would hire you folks to do the implementation of this. I mean, people who really know how to take details and move it out and get the structures in place. So those are some preliminary thinking about that.
Back to my question, is there anything that you would have done differently that you think the philanthropist would care about or would grab her?
I would have done two things differently right off the top. And the first thing I would have done when I was working with FEMA would be to go back and say, I need a lot more money to have this for a longer period of time. This was a one shot, and it's too bad. And I'm grateful for those who kept it going. But it's very hard to make these kinds of changes with just a in-and-out model. So you need something sustainable. And I'm talking about like a 15-year plan or a 20-year plan that really would impact the major institutions, education, business, faith-based, so on, that those would get impacted. That's one difference I would make, and I'm sorry I didn't do that. A second piece of that is that I think the dialogues were structured right, even to the extent that we did our research and found out that we sort of got in their way. I think they were done right. I think we just didn't have enough people who could give it the kind of time and attention that you needed. We almost needed to hire a staff, not a big group, but, I'm an academic, and I've got 10 dissertations I'm chairing and 4 classes to teach and all that sort of stuff. And then in addition, I'm doing this because I've got great passion for it. What happens is something slips. And so I wish I had actually buttressed a system in place to get the kind of an institutional base to keep that going.
Go to Ray and ask the question.
Well, I wasn't there when they devised the process for mediation. I would have done it completely differently. I would get rid of the approvals from the police department and the board, two organizations that I know they want like to feel that they're part of this, but they don't know. They're more obstacles than they should be. And I would make it quicker. The interesting part about the CCRB is that they're very concerned about timeliness, both in investigations and mediations. But they set time limits that are impossible to meet given the processes that they develop. When the CCRB broke from the police department and became independent, the board went on record and said, well, we think that an investigation can be done in 3 months, and it would only take 1 month for the board to review the case, so anything 5 months and older will be considered part of the backlog. Not 6 months later, they were complaining they could not make that schedule because in order for them to do it in 3 months, they need to get the documents from the police department, and that was not forthcoming. And they have never changed that definition. So you are working against yourself. Same thing is true with mediation. Waiting for approval slows us down. You know, you may be very upset when it first happens, but as time passes, you begin to say, well, why am I going to bother with this? And we lose them. So it would be nicer if we could have a more timely process where we could go directly from you filed the complaint, are you interested in mediation? Okay, let's see if we can get the officers okay about this and get you in here and sit down and talk about this. In terms of the philanthropists, the thing I would want is more staff who are mediators. That would do two things for me. One, I could depend on them to explain mediation well. Two, people who want to get a job in mediation could actually get a job. That's really one of my goals, is to try to deal with that problem.
Not one of mine, though.
And thirdly, I think if we could get an outreach person, people to do outreach, so that the civilians and the police know more about this process, it's unknown to them. And let me tell you, you don't get very far at roll calls standing up in front of a bunch of officers who are going out on patrol in about 4 minutes. You're not going to get very far.
Finally, let me ask the question to David. Your obvious, your initiative or your work was a little different. It was on a much larger scale. But whether or not you have any thoughts for models that might work for preventing things from escalating as you observed.
Yes? Okay. First of all, let me start, as Sandra did, with just answering the question about the funding, with a cautionary tale. There actually was a government agency that gave more than $50 million to develop community policing in America. It was the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services. And I sat on the U.S. National Academies of Science panel to assess what had been learned about policing and what progress had been made. And one of the conclusions we made two conclusions that are very relevant. First was that community policing was such a plastic concept that it was hard to tell what it was at any particular time, and therefore hard to evaluate whether it had any impact. So one thing I would caution or tell in an advisory is make sure when you think about these processes that you're identifying what you're doing in such a way that you could see what it actually does, that it's not a plastic concept that's a different thing to everybody you talk with. The second issue was that we found that with all the national investment in community policing, there had been almost no research on what practices actually made a difference. To do that, you need to do two things. One, you need to define clearly the outcomes. And in community policing, it was never clear whether the outcome was reducing crime, reducing fear, forging ties with the community, preventing problems of bias, etc. I mean, those were never clear. And if you read the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services website, you notice they want to do all those things at the same time, which is not necessarily very easy. And the second is, of course, you must develop programs that are testable and develop research. So you can't only invest in the program development. You have to invest in the research as well. So I would say when you think about spending your money, you should think carefully about those concepts and making sure that you don't have a sort of similar disaster to that of the federal government, which invested a great deal in these sorts of issues over a fairly long period of time after Clinton's crime bill. In terms of the lessons from our work was very different, but I'll link it to some work in the area of policing, another area that the Academy's panel that I was on dealt with, was my work suggests, as some of the other work as well, I think, that you can make progress in terms of what happens without necessarily radically altering who the people are and the belief systems they hold to. We often try to rehabilitate people to change them. Changing people is a very hard process. Anybody who has raised children knows how long it takes to take something and keep them out of jail, et cetera, and get them into college and all those things. It's a very hard process. Changing people is very difficult. There's a literature now that's been developing over the last 10 years on procedural justice or legitimacy. And in that literature, which I think is related to what we're doing, in that literature it suggests that if the police will just handle the people they deal with differently, if they'll explain to them what they're doing, if they'll let them know why it has to be done, if they'll change the nature of their interaction, it changes the outcome of the interaction for the offender. And indeed, there's evidence of reducing recidivism. What happened in Israel, I think, is a case that provides a little bit of similarity, where the government went off and tried to explain itself to the settlers, try to create a sense of doing it as a part of procedural justice, etc., and therefore came out with an outcome. And I would recommend that, and using the terms community policing, that you also look into the issues of procedural justice and legitimacy, of which there's been a lot of talk about, by the way, but as well, not all that much research.
Right, designers out there, how about a question for the panel? Yes.
Okay,
good.
And actually, I would love to have
Sounds like that would make my 50 million go farther. Let's have one response on that.
Question. That question assumes that you've got a reasonable level of literacy in that community. And that question also presupposes that the policeman on the other side is going to retrieve that email message and deal with the complaint. And also it assumes that the individual complainant is able to make use of that technology. It may not, in other words, what I'm trying to say is that may work in one community, but not in others.
Might be limiting.
It might be limiting, yes.
In line with what Dave was talking about in terms of defining best practices, I think technology can help us define success. So potentially, and in fact, this is what we did in Cincinnati. We asked everybody through the internet to share their ideals for the future of police-community relations. And the court order had us protect their names and identifiers, but the data was all available, still is. So we worked with the press, and the press therefore got the data about best ideals, and they wrote articles sharing people's visions. So it helped to create a context, the technology right there for access. As I said, we had 3,500 people involved. Of those 3,500 people, 2,500 came to us through the internet. And then in terms of folks who weren't internet savvy or didn't have internet, we did interviews. So we then also did surveys with about 1,000 people. At least a half of that 1,000 were youth. But all that data is in the database. And as I said earlier, as I was now quite happy 5 years later that the progress is being made, is this Police Community Partnering Center has now asked us for that data and has now asked us in particular for helping them to reach back out to the 3,500 people and invite them back to the table. They were lost earlier because as we move from the collaborative into the legal process, the collaborative process was sort of set aside. But now technology is enabling us to reach back out to them and invite them back to the table. So in this way, technology, I think, has been a great ally.
Let me turn to you, Jackie.
Okay, I'm interested in monitoring, and Najiba, you spoke this morning about the importance of oversight supervision, of monitoring the outcomes and the results of your work. And when I think about monitoring, I wonder who makes decisions about who does the monitoring? It raises issues of power in my mind. Are we talking about giving this task to the courts, as happened in Jay's situation? Are we going to give the citizen groups? In designing principles here, who are the superpowers here that do the monitoring?
Well, I think in our case, we initially, we were looking for an academic partner to evaluate our program. But what we found was very important is because we were in the design phase, we needed not just outcome evaluation, but we needed some kind of overarching process feedback as we were developing the program. So one of the things I think is very important in terms of monitoring is not just monitoring a program once it's set up, but also monitoring the design process to make sure the design process is inclusive of different parts of the police department as well as the community. And so I would encourage us to think about even the collaboration, design, and planning needs to be very deliberative in its process, and it needs to be inclusive, and that needs to be one of the things that is monitored. And additionally, we chose an organization that had a reputation for monitoring other police departments, the Police Assessment Resource Center. They also have the legal expertise to understand what monitoring means. They're not, because it's a voluntary process, we're doing dialogue and mediation. It was not monitored by the courts, but I do think it is important for us to consider even ADR processes, especially those that touch civil rights issues, to have some kind of outside monitoring agency or organization. And for us, we decided that we would open up our dialogues to monitoring as well, which raises issues of confidentiality, even our mediation process. So the way that we handle it is to have voluntary responses from participants who are a part of those dialogue sessions, but our monitor comes to all of our planning committee meetings, comes to all of our training of police officers and community members. So we basically allow them to permeate the design as well as the implementation process.
I pass it, I might note that I'm still holding on to my $50 million because even though there are some suggestions here for training and they're good and for education and suggestions for creating legitimacy and research on that, I'm interested in a prototype that can be replicated. And so I'm going to pass this on to Kathy with the hope that as a designer, she's going to lead you to a prototype or at least someone willing to put that out.
Certainly, Nancy.
No problem.
One of the things that I noticed as all of the panel members were discussing was a distinction between an institutionalizing or the institutionalization of a method and an institution which oversees or champions some kind of a dispute resolution mechanism. And I would draw the distinction between an institution versus institutionalization. And when this morning when we talked about institutionalization, we talked about an expectation. And Michael, I'm going to peg you for this one. You talked a little bit about power, and you talked about how power is determined and who has it and who doesn't have it. You also talked a little bit about the fact that now there is somewhat of an expectation that this is the way disputes around parades are handled. Okay, it's accepted. I would call that your method has been institutionalized. Could you talk a little bit about whether you gave any thought at all to an institution or something larger than just this one particular conflict?
I think absolutely right that one of the key things I think about the way that the Parades Commission and the mechanisms for dealing it have become institutionalized is it's been viewed as a process, and that at the starting point of that process you work with the narratives that people have. So one of the questions that was asked was, surely it's a big flaw when the largest parade organizer doesn't recognize the authority of the institution. But what has happened is that if you're prepared to work with that and find other creative ways around that, that over time people increasingly do buy into it. I think this question of the 50 million's pretty difficult because, if you start focusing on monitoring things as funders inevitably will do, and you know it's like an insurance policy or it's like traffic calming measures where the benefit is not seen until after, or in it may not ever be seen because something has been prevented. And so I'm not sure if we need to be talking about some grand institution that will wonderfully solve all the kind of police community relations that we're talking about. One of the things that I think has been instrumental in establishing the Parades Commission in Northern Ireland is the legislation that set it up and the symbolic power that law has in actually bringing about some kind of authority or credibility to something which otherwise wouldn't have. And it's also, it's not just about creating an institution, it's about looking at the institutions that we already have and how we can redefine those and devolve responsibility for policing to others.
Dominic, and then also I'd like to address the question to Jay. Did you want to answer, Dominic? No. Picked up the microphone. I assumed you had something to say.
I would just add very briefly that a comparison in Northern Ireland that might be pertinent is we have a constant debate about whether mediation should take place through the Parades Commission where it's enforced, or whether it should be taken away because that's not good mediation practice. And we have another organisation which is well funded by the government called Mediation Northern Ireland, which is sort of voluntary. So we have the sort of two models in Northern Ireland running.
Let me ask Jay, because you know you're involved here in the United States, and we have all kinds of IRS, TQM, ADR. I mean, we're the nation of initials. What's your thought on some kind of a dispute resolution or conflict management institution or something at a high level, a very macro level?
I'd like to ask for the $50 million to set up an institution that will do three things. First of all, it will work in communities around the country to collaboratively define success in improving police-community relations. So the job will be to get the community and the police and all the necessary stakeholders to collaborate on their definition of success. That definition in itself will be part of success. And this addresses the problem that we don't know how to assess prevention, but we can assess our effectiveness in reaching agreement about definition. So there's one issue. Secondly, having defined success, I then ask the institution to help us come up with a contingency approach for promoting success. And I talked about this earlier, that I'd suggest we need a contingency approach which would be based on an analysis of problems, which is the converse of defining success, right? The lack of success are the problems. So therefore, given a problem which is defined as indignity, where we disrespect one another, therefore the methodology probably is one focusing on identity-based approaches. Suggesting that the problem is about inequality and power disparities and so forth, probably we're going to want to look at either judicial or interest-based approaches. So we want to be able to develop a contingency model of processes that will promote success as defined. And then finally, we want to be able to have a very systematic and technology-driven assessment process. One of the big problems in our field of conflict resolution, conflict settlement, conflict management, or what I like to call conflict engagement, is that we don't have an overarching definition of success. The best we can do is come up with contextual definitions. In Cincinnati, we have a definition. We have five statements that the community and so forth have defined as success. We've now done a project in Detroit. We're doing another project in another city. And eventually, after we get enough definitions of success locally, we can begin to do comparative analysis. And maybe we can say, in police-community relations, here's an overarching definition of success. So institution that will help us define, promote, and then systematically assess success. Do I get it?
Thank you. Well, here is my answer. I'd give the $50 million to the group in this room if I could keep them here talking for another few days. I feel as though the components of a successful structure, a successful process are here, and you've persuaded me as a philanthropist that one doesn't get it in the first shot in any event, that even the great progress that we've heard about in light of the stakes that are involved has involved an iterative process in which something's tried and people of goodwill continue to change it, modify it, as time goes on. But I do think we're in a situation in which the $50 million is the least of the problems in terms of dealing with identity-based issues in community-based policing in this country, that the ideas and the writing up of the good experiences and the successes and communicating with each other about it is actually far more important at this point. Should that idea emerge, it seems to me somewhere in this country the $50 million is there. And therefore, we did this conference and tried to attract you to come with the idea that this would be the beginning of a conversation and the beginning of the research and the beginning of sharing of these experiences, not just within this country, but in terms of the experiences that we can find anywhere in the world. It certainly was valuable for us to listen. The notes that I wrote for this session at the beginning bear nothing, no resemblance at all to the notes that I wrote in the midst of the program. It is wonderful to listen. And with the stakes so high in finding resolution, every bit of violence, as Michael says, that one that doesn't happen, even if it can never show up in an assessment, is something that's exceedingly, exceedingly important. As I look out at students as well as others who are fellow researchers in the field, I recall one other theme throughout today, which is that people kept apologizing about not being experts in particular things. You know, I'm not an expert on your country, I'm not an expert on dispute resolution, I'm not an expert on policing. All through the day, no matter what it was, I'm not your expert on that. And we have, as academics, become experts very deeply in particular matters. One can see the real power that happens if people move a little bit beyond that and take some risks. I'm hoping, as the research develops, that people will be willing to take those risks and perhaps to collaborate in ways in which they can together make contributions in the field. The research questions are really fascinating. The question of who speaks for the group that we've heard all through the day, and can one depend on a political structure, and in what contexts? Does the goal depend on the dispute and the stakes, or is there a goal that one could agree upon for an institution like this? The problem one that ever could be determined as a success or failure in something like 5 to 10 years? Or are we going to have to try a variety of things and wait for the next generation, our best guesses, and wait for the next generation to find out? Does buy-in happen at the beginning, or does buy-in something that happens over a long period of time as clever people realize they need it and figure out a way to bring it in? And the questions could go on and on. I'm hoping that all of you are walking away today with a list of questions that's too long to fit between the time period that's allowed for me to list. But certainly one can't go away without great respect for the people who have come here today and who have done the kinds of research and the kinds of action that we've been hearing about throughout, and that they are willing to get on the plane and come here to share those experiences and that research with us really has made us rich. And we thank you for that.